Good evening and welcome. I am Star Figura, the Phyllis Ann and Walter Borton Associate Curator of Prints and Illustrated Books here at MoMA, and the curator of the exhibition, Lucian Freud, The Painter's Etchings, which is on view in the third floor exhibition galleries through March 10. In conjunction with the exhibition, tonight's in-depth exploration of Freud's work begins with a lecture by art critic, curator, and Freud biographer William Fever. It is followed by a screening of the film, Lucian Freud Portraits, and after that, a book signing. It is truly a pleasure and a privilege to have William Fever here tonight to speak about Freud's work. The curator of numerous Freud exhibitions, including the 2002 retrospective at the Tate, the author of countless books and articles on the artist, and a close friend and confidant of Freud's for more than 30 years. Fever, as Freud himself told me, quote, knows more about my work than I do. One of the few people who has ever been privileged to interview Freud on numerous occasions, for Freud is, as we'll see tonight, very private. The conversations and information that Fever has published form the absolute bedrock of Freud's scholarship. I'm delighted to introduce him now, not only because he's the foremost authority on Freud's work, and I know that we're in for a treat, but also because it affords me the opportunity to publicly acknowledge and thank him for the extremely generous advice and assistance that he gave me over the course of organizing our current exhibition. Suffice it to say that without his knowledge and input, the exhibition would not have been nearly as rich. After studying history at Oxford, William Fever received a research fellowship at Newcastle University, where he began a book on the apocalyptic British painter John Martin. He soon began to work as an art critic. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
He soon began to work as an art critic, first in Newcastle and then in London, for various newspapers and journals, including the Sunday Times, the Financial Times, and Vogue. For many years, he was an art critic for The Observer. Fever has curated numerous exhibitions on a wide range of topics related to British art, from George Cruikshank at the Victoria and Albert Museum in 1974, and 30s British art and design before the war at the Hayward Gallery in 1979, to the universally acclaimed Freud retrospective at the Tate in 2002. As well as other recent shows, including a major exhibition on John Constable for the Grand Palais in Paris in 2003, which was, in fact, organized in collaboration with his friend and fellow Constable lover, Lucian Freud. In addition to the exhibition catalogs for these and other shows, he has also written numerous books and articles on a range of subjects, including caricature, children's book illustration, and the Ashington Group of British Amateur Painters. He is currently working on a new book devoted to Freud's works on paper, as well as a major monograph on Frank Auerbach. In addition to all of this, Fever also finds time to devote to his own work as a painter. Following the lecture, we will watch Lucian Freud Portraits, a 66-minute film directed by Jake Auerbach and produced by Auerbach and Fever. This documentary was produced over a 2-year period from 2002 to 2004. When Auerbach and Fever interviewed and filmed many of Freud's subjects, from the Duke and Duchess of Devonshire to David Hockney. Intimate and revealing, the film provides an unprecedented window into the artist's exceedingly private world. After the screening, Bill Fever was signed copies of his latest book, Lucian Freud, in the lobby just outside this auditorium. At 488 pages, this monograph has been widely praised as the most definitive and in-depth reference on Freud's work to date, and was selected by the New York Times Art and Architecture critics as one of their favorite books of 2007. And during the book signing, there will also be time, I think, for any questions that you may have for Mr. Fever. Please join me now in welcoming William Fever.
Thank you, Star, very much indeed. I want to hurry along, rather, because I think there's an awful lot to be talked about and an awful lot to see. But I'd like to start with a tribute to Star and to the staff of MoMA, because I want to give them a European equivalent of the magnificent technical facilities available here. This is the Museo Cora in Venice. And up those stairs, those marble stairs, all Freud's work for a great retrospective we had a couple of years ago were marshalled. It took 12 men to carry some of the paintings. Unlike here, where people use things like elevators and other high-tech equipment, you use manpower in Italy. And at the top of the stairs, and they ran up the stairs singing with 5-ton paintings, at the top of the stairs, we had an image which is Freud's image in the world at large, which is very much more than life size. It's 16 feet tall. And I thought I'd start tonight by thinking for a moment about Freud's image. First of all, it's the word Freud, the family name, which meant that from virtually birth, Lucian Freud and his brothers were singled out as being peculiar people who had surely got a lot of Freudian aspects to their lives and characters. Freud, Lucian Freud, is now, I suppose it could be said, certainly in Europe, a bigger name than Sigmund Freud. Because, whereas Sigmund Freud is now a character in psychoanalytical history, Lucian Freud is a living, active, working artist. Yet, naturally, the 16-foot image, which is so imposing and which is what the public and the world at large knows, is a different scale and different character to the actual painting itself, which is very small, which was painted something like 3 feet away from the mirror reflection, and which is, as you can see, a slightly wolfish, slightly furtive, slightly sinister, slightly predatory character. And those are all adjectives which I've read into the painting. Being a typical art historian, I like to read things into things which aren't necessarily there. The reason Freud's expression is like this, of course, is because he's squinting sideways at his own expression in a mirror. And to paint your profile straight from life is quite a difficult feat. Well, the small painting is what I want to concentrate on tonight, because the small paintings are the essence of Freud's paintings and the essence of the man. But there's one other illusion about Freud I'd like to dispel straight away, and that is that he's a very, very serious, solemn, portentous kind of person. This is Freud doing a lugubrious expression, because I'd mentioned the name of a well-known art dealer to him. Not his present dealer, I hasten to add. And Freud in conversation, Freud in character, Freud in private life, and Freud in general dealings with humanity and with the animal kingdom is a lively, energetic, and very funny character. And although his work is not witty in the sense of being ha-ha, it is always work which strikes very directly and with no pretenses at what people are like and what he feels about them. It's very direct. Bit of biography. This is a corner of what was Matthäuskirch Strasse in Berlin. This photograph I took about 20 years ago, I suppose, and it's Matthäuskirch Platz, bisected by the Berlin Wall. I'm standing next door to the Neue National Gallery, designed by Mies van der Rohe, great friend of Freud's father, Ernst Freud, son of Sigmund, who was an architect. The fact that the Berlin Wall, of course, cuts across where the Freuds had lived for the first nearly 11 years of Lucien's life is, of course, itself an historic indication. The family left Berlin in 1933, about 6 months after Hitler came to power. So they weren't propelled out of the country. They didn't flee for their lives or anything like that. But they felt that it was no longer possible to stay in Berlin in Germany, and they got out with their possessions. So therefore, not being refugees, they were comfortably off and settled in London. Lucien has never gone back to Germany. He forgot his German as quickly as he could. He changed his style of writing from Germanic script to a very badly formed kind of English script. And he became very rapidly an English schoolboy. This English schoolboy didn't take to education. He was asked to leave his first boarding school. And his second boarding school he left because he dropped his trousers in a seaside town with a bet with a friend, as one does at the age of 15. And went to art school in London instead, the best possible destination for him. He didn't last at the art school because they asked him to do some work. And so he ended up in 1939 near Willy Lott's cottage. Now, I suppose some of you may not know of Willie Lott's cottage. It's the cottage in Constable's painting, The Hay Wain, the most famously beloved, used on table mats painting in English art. And for Freud, from Berlin, with a slight German accent, found the Central School of Art in London a bit too much for him, landed himself in this Suffolk village next door to the Constable country, was, I suppose, odd, bizarre. Freud loved Constable. He thought Constable, even at the age of 16 when he went to this art school, was someone worth studying, worth enjoying, because Constable felt friendly to animals and friendly to the things that Lucien particularly liked. I mean, the only thing he liked about his schools was being able to milk the goats and ride the horses. Lodgings at this art school were all over the village of Denham. Freud lodged at the Marlborough Head, black and white house on the left. Unfortunately, he went to bed late one night and woke up to find the art school just across the road, vacant lot, was burning down. He'd been smoking in the art school late, and so he'd burnt the art school down. Now, that is not untypical of Freud's approach to education systems, and the fact he came to the opening here is quite remarkable the building survives. Anyhow, the school burnt down, and people started immediately saying, because his name got into the papers for the first time, that Freud, aha, grandson of Sigmund, he was obviously doing something, because suspicion about the burning of the school down did very quickly centre on him. Childhood reading, Struwelpeter, which is not approved by children's book librarians, but was one of the most popular children's books of the 19th century, and he was brought up in it, in which naughty little children, mostly little boys, do things which get terrible punishments. In this case, for sucking your thumb, you get your thumb chopped off. For thumb, if you're a Freudian, of course, you read some other part of your body. Freud was obviously conscious of his grandfather. His grandfather came to England in 1939, and he was fond of him anyhow, because he used to dish out gold guineas and click his false teeth at him and take them in and out to show him, which is an endearing habit in a grandfather. But Sigmund Freud also was the only member of the family who gave Lucien art to think about and remember. He gave him a set of prints of Bruegel's Seasons. And the thing that really stuck in Lucien's mind about this was the wonderful cows in the late autumn scene. Not just the fact they were cows, but look at the eyes and look at the girth. You know, cows have these enormous bums and they lurch down a lane, prodded as they go to be milked or slaughtered or whatever. Freud's love of animals, which is not a sentimental love, but it's a very fierce, defensive, and even at times quite aggressive love, also involves, or used to involve, how the horses were concerned, large sums of money. Freud's love of animals, I think, stems from images like this as much as from the animals themselves. But certainly, as he grew up, as he developed, he became someone who automatically didn't go in for the automatic modernism of then being taught in art schools. He was very much his own man from the age of 15 or 16 onwards. His teacher, Cedric Morris, was a very good one, as it turned out, because he too was very idiosyncratic. This is Freud's portrait of his teacher. Freud was about 16 at the time. And it's, you can see, a sly, sharp man who preserved a lot of his love for cultivating irises. He gave up painting in favour of becoming Europe's leading iris grower, possibly the world's leading iris grower. Freud liked this about him. He liked the idea that you paint directly, you look at someone directly, and you treat people almost, as it were, like animals. I must go back one. In 1941, Freud was 18. The war was on. Freud didn't want to get called up, conscripted. So he decided to run away and join the Merchant Navy, partly because he wanted to evade going to the army, but also because he wanted to come to New York and meet Judy Garland, as he puts it. He managed to more or less stow away on board a ship, became a kind of cabin boy, had a very miserable time. He was beaten up by the ship's cook, who chased him with an axe. I thought this was one of Lucien's stories, but actually I checked it with the ship's logbook. And he came back after a pretty terrifying time. It was winter, 1941. Convoys were being sunk at a terrible rate. They were attacked from the air, they were attacked from submarines, and this was Lucien's great trip abroad. It took him about 4 months, got back to England with acute tonsillitis. The ship's doctor took pity on him, and he was discharged. And great relief, sent to a military hospital, and there he is convalescing. Now, I'm not dwelling on these early pictures because he is, after all, only 18 at the time. They are not great works of art, but they are extraordinarily well-formed for somebody of that age. Within a couple of years, he'd left Cedric Morris's school, and he settled in London, and he settled in what has become his practice ever since, which is to live in the area which is called Paddington, which is north of Hyde Park, the great green open space, the Central Park of London, and is bisected by canals and railways, and it's very grotty, and it's full of prostitution, burglary, crime of all sorts, and Lucien Freud. He set himself up as a young 19-year-old artist in what he here calls the painter's room. You could call this surrealism. It's actually someone showing off his skill with humbral oil enamel paints, shiny paints, all he could get at the time, and he thought Picasso used them, therefore he could, why not? Setting himself up with what you could call a psychiatrist's couch, but actually was just a couch he happened to have, palm tree, and a stuffed zebra head, which his wonderful new girlfriend had given him because she was very good at giving spontaneously exciting and exotic and rather surreal presents. The stripes are imaginary. The painting was done at a time when flying bombs were falling. A flying bomb landed very close to the apartment in which he was living, and the glass of the windows was shattered, and the easel in the middle of the room was undamaged. That painting was on it, and it survived. The girlfriend, who I put together two portraits of her with a painting of a heron she'd given him, a dead heron, she loved giving you dead things, was a great influence on him. She was a married woman. She was 10 years older than him, no more than 10, nearly 15 years older than him. She had as her other lover, the poet Laurie Lee, and I think quite wisely found Lucien more interesting. And in those two little paintings, one of which is up in the museum because it was bought by Alfred Barr for MoMA in 1948, in these two paintings, Freud is at last starting to see other people as people with characters, emotions of their own. This is a very young man painting people, painting a woman, that he actually decides that he loves, and there's something about her which is secret and reserved. Actually, the secret and reserve is partly because she'd found letters from another girlfriend and had thrown him out, and so they're kind of mourning paintings as well as being celebrations. This is not the actual girlfriend whose letters Lorna found, but she's, from this period, an example of how Freud was already painting in mature style. People generally, fellow art historians, love to think that Freud, born in Germany, Freud must have known Neue Sachlichkeit, he must have been a great follower of Otto Dix, he must have had that sort of Germanic inbred genetic training which precludes anything other than this sharp sort of focus. Of course, that's nonsense, partly because Freud left Germany for good in period before he was aware of anything like contemporary German painting, but also because the paintings he knew, the paintings he came across, particularly during the war, were mostly Flemish, Netherlandish paintings, and these are very clearly, this sort of painting is very clearly a Netherlandish painting based on things like Memling, in which typed painting and attributes, emblems, are very naturally put together. So that the Madonna holds an apple, the child is a real sort of, I'd say, Belgian child, and this is not Germanic, this is Freud or Memling doing their own thing. Freud and labels don't actually attract themselves very much, because Freud was also, at the same time, fascinated by what he could get hold of contemporary, particularly European art. As it happened, the owner of this painting, Roland Penrose, gave it, very trusting man, Roland Penrose, to Freud to take from London to Brighton one day by train. And Freud took it into the carriage and sat it down in front of him, opposite him, and looked at it all the way and thought, this is the most extraordinary image. And it had an enormous effect on him. because it's the limits of exaggeration in art at the time. A painting done in, I think, 1938, Crying Woman, which her handkerchief and her tears and her misery and her self-pity all meld together. So at the same time as doing the Memling-type paintings, he was conscious that there was another kind of art going on which he should be aware of. In 1946, he met Picasso for the first time, and they got on well. He met through his nephew. Freud went to Greece. The self-portrait upstairs was done in Greece. And he broadened his horizons which ever since then have been resolutely very narrow. In 1951, he painted this painting for what was then called the Festival of Britain, a series of 50 paintings commissioned from artists, given large supplies of canvas. Canvas was in very short supply in Britain at the time. And Freud produced this extraordinary painting, which in 1951 looked completely freakish. And I suppose it's remained the same ever since, that Freud has never quite fitted in with movements or isms or schemes of things. This painting of Harry Diamond, a Soho drinking companion, facing the palm tree which you'll have seen four or five slides ago. Confrontation, you could call it existential, you could call it very much art brute, you could call it anything you like, but actually what it's of is of the corner of Freud's rather decrepit apartment overlooking the canal, and outside is a dank London afternoon. The style is now mature. The style is assured. Look at those toe caps. Look at the plant fronds. Freud got married once or twice around this period. This is his second wife. As you can see, she and Freud in a Paris hotel room didn't really get on that well. She had one of her headaches, and he brooded over her. Of course, I say that, but actually Freud wanted to do a two-hander, him and somebody else in a painting. Two hands are very different from portraits, single heads, or even single people and single plants. His second wife, Caroline, who later married Robert Lowell, she married several times and always picked people of what you might call difficult living-in habits. Never mind, became a considerable novelist in her own right, and Freud was very, very upset when she left him. She very understandably left him. He adored her, and one of his themes, I suppose, in his work is the theme that if you're a committed artist and if you are, I suppose, basically rather romantic-minded, your ties are first of all to your work, your ethos is your work, and the people you're involved with are people who serve your work to some extent. It's either, you can say, extremely selfish, or it's, on the other hand, extremely rational. He learned a lot of this from Francis Bacon. Francis Bacon became, well, again, you can exaggerate and say became a kind of wife, but he wasn't at all. They were never close in the sense of being lovers or anything like that. But Freud, 15 years younger than Bacon, was fascinated by the elder man who lived a completely bohemian life in which risk was something you had to go for every time, risk of all kinds. His portrait of Bacon, which, as it happens, was stolen from the Neue National Gallery when it was on a Freud exhibition about 15 years ago and hasn't been seen since, and if anybody's got any word of it, there's a major award out for it. It belongs to the Tate. This painting is tiny. It's on copper. It's one of the last paintings that Freud did in his Netherlandish, what I call his Netherlandish style, and it shows this kind of bruised cherub, this person who looks innocent and looks weirdly young for his age, but is actually, of course, full of the kind of traumas which he so memorably produced. He memorably produced them, and he produced them in a style which is absolutely the opposite of anything that Freud ever attempted or thought he'd attempt. Freud was very much the younger man. Bacon loathed anybody of any ability near him. He always picked on peculiarly bad painters to praise. He thought Freud's work was really no good at all, so descriptive. And this was something to do with the way in which, for Bacon, a painting was something that you risked everything at, you swiped it, and if likely and if possible, you destroyed it. You only allowed a few of your completed works out. So a self-portrait by Bacon is totally unlike, at that stage, a portrait of him by Freud. On the other hand, there are things which bind them together and held in common. For example, this double spread from a book of Egyptian arts, which Freud had owned from the age of about 15. I think his father gave it to him, he can't quite remember, but anyhow, he got this book, and he still got it, and it's spattered with paint, and it falls open naturally at this double spread of anonymous sculptors from a period of about 1500 BC, when, for the first time in, I think, art history, or in the history of mankind, people's genuine features, people's real portraits, portraits of the pharaoh Akhenaten, and some of his subjects were made. And for Freud, this was good information. But more than that, these are wonderful images, and you can see they sort of match the portrait of Bacon. However, he had to change his style, he had to develop. He couldn't carry on doing this kind of microscopic juvenile work. And gradually he started puddling the paint and working wet into wet, building out from centre outwards, usually from the sinuses sort of thing, outwards. This unfinished portrait of Bacon he thought was a disaster and wouldn't allow it to be sort of seen for years. And eventually, about 5 or 6 years ago, he asked me to go to a private, secret address and inspect this derisory picture. And I said, it's great, it's wonderful. So it was allowed out. And it's, happily, because the other Bacon portrait's missing, it's a picture which shows a sort of stylistic and moral development between the two. I think, in its way, it's better than the one that belongs to the Tate, because it's got more introspection, it's got more more character to it. Freud always says that he wants there to be at least two expressions in the same, in the one face, and never more so than when he's painting himself. This is not actually himself. He calls it the procurer. It's of a man who he heard in a pub one day saying, will you charge it to my bill, the Freud bill? This man was passing himself off as Freud. And Lucian was rather interested, so he had him round. The man brought girls with him because he thought that was what Freud would be interested in, which indeed, why not? But Freud said he prefers to find girls for himself. And he found this man completely loathsome, so he painted him. And because the man had passed himself off as Freud, and because he actually did have a sort of resemblance to him, there was this furtive air. And this is the first time that in a self-portrait, or sort of vicarious self-portrait, pseudo-self-portrait, Freud has come close to this double expression idea. Now, this is in the 1950s and early 60s, and it's a time when every other stream of art was not involved in this kind of work. But in some ways, always, whether you're a pioneer, the head of the avant-garde, or whether you're idiosyncratic, somehow in the course of time, the two separate paths merge. And what became, for Freud's idiosyncrasies, non-avant-garde idiosyncrasies, actually, I think now, in the context of the 1950s and 60s, these paintings look absolutely apposite, and they fit in. As it happens, these two pictures, I didn't hang them together, but they go together. This is George Dyer, who was Bacon's boyfriend, who he had a long affair with in the 1960s, and who committed suicide the very morning that Bacon's retrospective at the Grand Palais in Paris, the great sort of summit of his career, opened, killed himself and was a destructive person altogether, a very pathetic person. And Freud occasionally would take him away with him to give Francis time to work on his own, because the poor man was always getting drunk and being beaten up, and he was basically a lost soul. To Freud, in Scotland, with George, occupying George by painting him, and also at the same time painting this foal, which he'd bought. Goodness knows why, he got nowhere to keep it. But the two between them, painted at the same time, are a correspondence. It's, I suppose, a bit trite to say that we are animals and animals have got traits ascribed to them, which are sort of human. But actually to face animals and paint them in the same way that you paint people, there is a kind of symbiosis, there is a kind of way in which they overlap and they interact. And you can see that in paintings of people with horses and people with dogs, see Titian, and it works. Freud also was a great developer of relationships with people who you wouldn't expect to have relationships with. These are neighbours, mostly. On the right, Michael Andrews, painter friend, with his nightclub hostess girlfriend. In the middle, John Deakin, who took photographs of naked women and other people for Bacon and was a kind of terrible Soho reprobate. And on the left, the one I really warmed to, Ted and his daughter. Ted did banks. Ted got sliced in the face any number of times, so his face became more and more interesting to Freud as the seams healed up. Sharon, the daughter, became involved in a famous English scandal, sex scandal, political scandal of the early 60s, the Profumo affair. I find very relevant to all good art is the anecdotes behind them and the correspondences and the way that stories develop and people have a history. Well, at the time when Ted sat, he was just a neighbour in this rundown part of Paddington. But as time went on, Ted's resonances increased. This is the rundown part of Paddington, and that's the rundown Freud, and the car is a Bentley. Freud was customarily broke throughout most of his working life. He took great pains to be broke, thanks to the horses. He gambled at a colossal rate, like Bacon, because gambling is a kind of akin to the way in which you have to edit yourself as a painter and destroy the things you like and destroy the things that don't come up to scratch. And if you don't do that, you're not such a good painter. Well, Freud was photographed in the early 60s. He doesn't like being photographed. He hates it. Photographs of him are relatively rare. And it's a brilliant photograph of him refusing to be photographed at the same time maneuvering himself in a position where he is photographed. And, of course, this car in this rundown part of London could only belong to a pimp or someone who's done extremely well in the safe-breaking business, or indeed Lucian Freud. So the disreputable is very important in his work. At the same time, simultaneously, and this I think probably could only happen in England, he was friends with dukes, and actually more particularly duchesses. This is the Duke of Devonshire. It's a what we call a location shot I took from our film, you'll see later on. But I included it here because there's the Duke, and there's the Duke's mother on the wall above. There's the Duke's sister below the mother, just by the bell pull. This is in Chatsworth, the finest stately home in Britain, and Freud decorated one of the bathrooms, one of the many bathrooms, with a kind of floral mural, which didn't get beyond three leaves because the Duke asked him to leave the place because Freud wasn't behaving himself. They remained good friends, and he did a very good portrait of the Duke. And Freud, as an emigrant from Germany, loved the idea that if you go into a strange society, it's almost, I suppose, like arriving at Staten Island in 1910. You are free of all ties, and you can join society at whatever level you choose. Your ambitions are open, and you can paint the Duchess. You can be friends with the Duchess. You can paint the bank robber. You can paint your friend, the nightclub hostess. You can move in society in ways in which isn't really very common in most societies. The artist is the free spirit. In this painting, which was bought by the Duke, as it happens, because the Duke was his great patron at the time, Freud's then one of his girlfriend at the time is in the back, the foreground, the mother. And well, I gave a talk in Los Angeles a few years ago to about 250 psychoanalysts, and they all found the pestle and mortar utterly fascinating. It could only mean one thing. I resist symbolic explanations of paintings, although there's no reason why a bit of symbolism shouldn't come into place. Actually, and this is around about the time I first met Freud, he did have a pestle and mortar. He used to grind up charcoal and mix it in with the paint to make it more Londonish. And you have to have something in the foreground. Mother's feet aren't enough, so you bung in the pestle and mortar. That's fact. Supposition is, of course, that it's to do with the son and the mother and the girlfriend. The mother is unaware of the girlfriend. And Lucien himself has said that Giorgione's La Tempesta is also responsible, the idea of two totally disassociated people in one painting. But, of course, the painting is really about mother. Mother, I haven't really mentioned her up to now, but mother was extremely important. Mother was quite a distinguished classicist, but she lived for her sons, her three sons, and in particular for her middle son, Lucian. She named her sons after archangels, Lucian Michael, named after the archangel Michael, and she adored Lucian. She adored him to distraction. She adored him to the extent that she would collect the letters that he sent to his girlfriends in order to keep them for her personal bottom drawer archive. Lucian found her absolutely and totally, as one would, impossible. But When his father died in 1970, his mother became extremely depressed and tried suicide and became sort of catatonically detached and miserable. At last, Lucien felt he was on equal terms with her and he could do something for her, and so he started to paint her. And for 15 years, just on, he painted her time and again. There are some of the middle period etchings upstairs and at least one brilliant painting of his mother. This is, I think, the finest. It's unparalleled in art of any time, any period, I think, this extraordinary devotion to the image of one person. And they're not sentimental at all, because he remained wary of her. But in a way, you can't do a more loving thing than paint the person that you spend your attention to. Also, the last thing an artist can do for their parent or the loved person is to draw them or paint them when dead, which Lucien did for his mother. The idea that you can actually contribute to their life by immortalizing them, as it were, is something which is obviously foremost in Lucien's mind at the time, but he never mentions it. He always says that he used to see him with his mother, and his mother would be totally silent, and he would be more silent than usual. But when I was hanging the Tate exhibition, he came round, and I thought, oh, God, he's going to freak out and he's going to demand enormous changes or this, that and the other. He just had one thing he wanted to do, and he said very quietly, William, would you very much mind if you put a painting of me next to my mother? I thought, my goodness, that is a weird concession. And of course it fits beautifully. The mother in etching, the mother in painting, and Lucien himself seen in a mirror stuck in a window. Three images in which there's a kind of tacit relationship. And this painting is another of these furtive glances in which there's a complete invention. There's nothing like it in art before or indeed since. Tiny painting, which is a great artist's self-portrait. When his father died, Freud got depressed. Not that he got on with his father particularly, but one gets depressed if one's a man, when one's father dies, whatever one's relationship to them. And when he's depressed, he tends to paint outdoors. He paints not outdoors plein air, he paints through the back window. And this is one of his dodgy flats, apartments in the same part of London he's always lived in which the landscape gardening leaves a good deal to be desired. You'll notice gradually that although this is good London flat front houses, in fact stucco fronted, handsome buildings now sell for the millions and millions, in those days were council owned, were going to be pulled down, but were saved by people who protect 19th century London. But at the time, multi-occupied, and you can see the abandoned sofas up on the flat roof, it's a scene of sort of tenement. Good times, aristocratic houses almost, fallen on very hard times. Freud loves this. He loves the history, the clues, not that far from 221B Baker Street, the ideas that you can get from the mattresses, the filthy, sweaty, stinking, abandoned mattresses. And the winos used to camp out in that patch. And he got very agitated because they started to rearrange the mattresses, and the painting took 18 months to do. Equally, because it's wrong to say that an artist goes through phases which are exclusive, Freud's always done two or three things at once. There's usually three or four or five even paintings on the go. How banal these are. Bunch of flowers in a sink. Naked girl. Well, they are banal, but of course they're completely original paintings. The painting of a buttercups, in which the buttercups are absolutely buttercuppery. This painting on the right, which belongs to Steve Martin, and is a most wonderful painting of a young body, and self-consciously so. One of the first nude paintings, naked paintings, he'd done for many years, and he'd only done a couple before this. And this was to become, for some years, his preoccupation. And it's a psychological preoccupation. This is the woman who was in the double portrait with his mother, and she's adopting a position, as all his sitters do, of their own choice. And she's a person of great temperament. And she and Lucien would fight on double-decker buses. They'd fight all over the place. She slightly frightened him, quite rightly. And it was tempestuous and passionate, and it's all sort of there. It's a tiny painting, and it's a very intimate one. And This is painted during the 70s, at a time when, of course, the idea of the man painting woman was becoming disrespectful or disreputable, and in particular, painting a daughter, one of his many daughters. This is Rose, who you'll see in the film, featuring very strongly. A painting I was accosted on a radio program by somebody a few years ago saying, what sort of man allows himself to paint his daughter, and particularly what sort of mother would allow a daughter to be painted by a man, by the father? Well, my only answer, I couldn't really think of what to say, was that no girl of 18 normally would do anything that either parent would tell her, so Rose did what Rose chose to do. And prurient thoughts aside, which I think completely irrelevant, it's an extraordinary picture of a 18-year-old young woman deciding, after years of not habitating the same places, even the same city as her father, because most of Freud's children have no connection with him when they are young or until they're fairly grown up, getting to know her parent, getting to know her father, in the interim of being, in this case, a nightclub bouncer. Another daughter, and you can tell, I don't want to say anything about this, except that it's a touching and rather pathetic image, a very beautiful one. And actually, the nakedness in the previous painting and the non-nakedness in this are equally telling, I think. And it's significant that these paintings have aroused a great deal of, I suppose, understandable annoyance, anger, and even outrage. But actually, for Freud, and in his context, they're very different. This is, I suppose you could say, the feminist take on painting one's daughter naked. It's from Beatrix Potter. It's Samuel Whiskers. He's tied up Tom Kitten, and he's sitting on the bare boards, and he's about to eat him. This is the image of the terrible predatory male gaze. But actually, when you look at Freud's, and when you talk to Freud's sitters, and you talk to the people who have anything to do with him, it's the situation is not like that at all. You'll see accounts of this in the film, and I don't want to say anything more. Except that painting people is, for Freud, the absolute central essence of what painting should be for him. Two people, father and son, Irishmen, Irish hands, you could say, certainly people ill at ease in London. In Freud's, he still has this studio, a room, top floor, overlooking West London, in which the characters are dedicated, devoted to Freud, so keen on his work, as keener than anybody else, at a time when people didn't like his work or buy it or appreciate it at all, hardly. And in time, the boy standing behind the father goes up into the man on the right, and that's his younger brother, and stories go on over the decades. The father has now died, the son has inherited the friendship, so to speak, with Freud. You'll notice the funny shape. That's because Freud's taken, for the last 30 years, to enlarging canvases whenever it feels like it, whatever the painting demands. It does become a little tricksy, and owners don't like it because seams keep opening up in pictures, and Freud explains that it's perfectly right because this happens to Rubens's as well. So there we go. Another anonymous ordinary man. We don't normally have names in Freud portraits. This is Seated Man, I think it's called. They're always called Man Seated or Seated Man or something like that. This is actually Baron Thiessen, who in the late 20th century was the great European collector. Slightly ill-gotten gains from his father, who ran Krupps, and was armaments for all sides. And when Heine Thiessen came to Lucien's studio to sit, he was accompanied by three detectives, always, for safety reasons. But while Freud has shown him that he's got a sort of Thiessen-type suit on, and he looks as though he's got plenty of time in which to sit and pose, he's actually a man like anybody else. What's significant about it, partly, not just the paint rags, which Freud always has hanging around the studio, which become a motif in the paintings, what's significant is that Heine Thiessen had a little Watteau, which Lucien actually never seen, but which he reconstructed in the studio using various girlfriends and children of his and a stray child replacing one of his grandchildren. Now, this extraordinary painting, which is very large, it's about, I suppose, the size of the projection here, has been variously misinterpreted by all sorts of people. A, saying it's awkward. Well, of course it's awkward. It's meant to be awkward. Secondly, that it's unrealistic. And of course it's unrealistic. It's a tableau. It's a studio setup. And throughout art, or rather throughout art from, I suppose, the 17th century onwards, and from Rembrandt onwards, really, there have been endless occasions in which painters have dressed people up and plonked them down in the studio to represent something, usually a biblical story, or in this case, a Watteau, Piero and his admiring girlfriends. Piero's slightly dim, that's Kai, the sun, in yellow. Bella Freud, now the fashion designer, with a mandolin. Girlfriend on the left, who's a painter. Girlfriend on the right, former girlfriend, who's a painter and is the mother of Rose, who you saw naked a few slides ago. I don't want to go into complications too much, but you'll see more of them in the film. What really is the point here is that this is the interaction of people, and it's the interaction of people in a tableau with a woody setting. The Watteau had a woody setting, a forest glade, and on the left there's a sink which replaces a fountain. Now, it's a very sort of banal thing to do, but it also relates to great painting. This is one of Freud's favourite paintings, favourite Titians, in which, I suppose to our eyes, these are not only sort of 16th century painting and it's elaborate, we don't know what's going on, it's Diana and her acolytes, it's a lot of naked women, it's an elaborate composition, and it's very much Venetian painting, and it's very much of its own period. Freud loves it for the elaborate orchestration of limbs, and he wants to achieve it himself. And he learns from Titian, not from a kind of art school or what's going on kind of training. He also owes a great deal to people like Courbet, French painting particularly. This amazing and wonderful Courbet, which unfortunately is not at the Met, but it was in the Courbet show in Paris because it belongs to the Louvre a few weeks ago, and is the allegory of Courbet's studio life, in which there's Courbet, surrounded by figments of his imagination, people of all races, people of all ages. There's a gamekeeper who was supposed to be Napoleon III, who he disliked. There's his childhood self, dimly visible there, a naked woman, and of course Courbet is painting a landscape. So it's a painting with a joke in the middle of it and huge amount of ramification, symbolic or otherwise, around it. No wonder Freud wants to do something like this in his own way at some point. Steady on, though. Better to start with something reasonable, like a small early Cézanne. Freud's dealer suggested that why not just get a Cézanne? So he got one. And he got this little one of a kind of brothel scene, one of those very raunchy, rough cast early Cézannes, thrown over a chair, bit of fumbling going on, and a servant coming in with the drinks. That incident is an Auerbach above it. Freud painted it on a huge scale, rather like the Watteau painting was on a huge scale compared to the original. And there it is. You can see slightly clumsy, and there's a servant coming in. He knew there was something wrong with this picture, and so by the end of it, clothes had come off the servant to make it all seem more natural, more ordinary, more unremarkable. And it's a painting which I think works on several levels and doesn't work on several levels. It works on the levels of being a kind of modern Cézanne, rather like Manet's Olympia was a modern Titian, or in those days modern Titian. It's a kind of homage by one artist to another. It's also a reinvention by an artist, and it's extremely awkward because, after all, it was an awkward situation, and it's an inexplicable situation, and the painting's gone off to Canberra, where it caused huge offence because Canberra spent an awful lot of money on it. Freud loves the idea that in his work, he should tackle the things which are not exactly unmentionable or taboo, but which are unpaintable or undoable. Notably here, behind him, as he's thinking, Lee Bowery. Lee Bowery from Melbourne, who came to London to find, well, not fortune, but enjoyment, shaved himself in every detail, dressed up in the most extraordinary costumes, and became a kind of nightclub sensation in the late 80s and early 90s. Freud came across him, actually standing in a queue. He found his ankles extraordinary, he said, and he got to know him and asked him to sit for him. And he sat and he sat and he sat naked, because without the costumes he became just a private person, and adopting the most baroque poses, which normally nobody could actually do, for hours on end. He was a kind of trial of strength between him and Freud, who would weaken or would get tired first. This painting's in the Met, and it shows him as a kind of man mountain. Actually, he wasn't very tall, and he was very mousy looking, and ordinary clothing, you wouldn't look twice at him in the street. But he was a great inspiration for Freud because he was rather like Velázquez painted dwarves. He was a kind of freak body, a freak person who was becoming an individual thanks to Freud. A huge painting. This is in Los Angeles. The paintings were this a show in Los Angeles. Him and his dresser lying on a bed. Etching. Freud resumed etching, having stopped doing it for many years in the 1970s. And this etching is one of the greatest, I think. And in the middle, you just see a naked self-portrait of Freud himself. Because if you're painting naked people, in the end, you should do it yourself. Libari died at the time he died of AIDS, and a friend of his called Sue Tilly took over from him. And we'll see quite a lot of her in the film, in one, more sense than one. And she became his next great female mountainous model, and she's wonderful. A painting of her upstairs, one of the best kneecaps in Western art, I'd say. I have to say the director of the Tate got really upset that I was including this in the exhibition and tried to dissuade him that it wasn't a good painting, and I think it's a wonderful painting. And it is a wonderful painting. Look at that. Fantastic. And it's done with, I won't say affection because that would be sentimental, but it's done with fascination. And it's done on absolutely equal terms. She's a bank manager's daughter, incidentally. And she's game for anything. And then, because he's brilliant at doing the things you don't bother to do. I mean, Still Life at the Sink. It's called The Two Japanese Wrestlers. There's a press cutting up in the corner there, and you see a couple of sumo wrestlers. It's virtuoso. By this stage, he'd quarreled with Bacon, partly because Bacon didn't like Lucien having success. And he quarreled with him partly because Bacon said, this is banal. But of course it isn't. Nothing in life's banal if you look at it sufficiently intently or with some sort of affection. And if you're a Freudian, dripping tap and plug hole, need I say more? Naked portraits. By this stage, Bacon paintings were getting very bland and very formulaic. Freud was inventing all the time. This young man, he's the son, actually, of the crouched over naked woman of some slides ago. And that's his father reflected in the window, sideways on. He's one of Lucien's sons. And he stands rather like Rodin's John the Baptist. And he's almost life-size in the painting. And it's a virtuoso painting. Various art historians have said that this is a sordid place, squalid surroundings. Of course, it's not. It's actually Holland Park, very smart address in London. And the mottled plaster is simply because it's more interesting to paint that way. And downstairs in the house, which Lucien occupies, there's a Rodin Balzac. And that, again, reflects in the painting. It's not pretentious. It's not competing. But like all artists do, it's making connections. From the son, Freddie, to Rodin, to Bruce Bernard, another Soho acquaintance and great admirer of Freud, who did the last big Freud book, and was a kind of sulky, mutinous character. And Lucien had known him for years. He'd known him as a schoolboy, because when he went down to see Lorna's son at boarding school, Bruce was at the same school, age of 16, a heavy smoker, and Lucien used to take him cigarettes. This was during the war. Well, Bruce stood mutinously, and it's a brilliant portrait of someone who's absolutely intent on not moving, but he admires Lucien so much and will do anything for him. And there's the painting, ready, finished. There's a bit of Libari on the left. And there's Lucien's self-portrait at the age of 70, naked. He thought he'd better do himself naked after all this time, on the go, and becoming slightly satanic or satiric looking, and actually turning into one of the great portraits, artist self-portraits of the modern age. Freud admires certain people. Man on the right he admires more than anybody else, that's Frank Auerbach. Not because Frank Auerbach was Kindertransport, left Germany, he's 10 years younger than Freud, but was sort of in the same boat as Freud. But he admires him because he's a painter who he thinks can do things which he, Freud, can't. not necessarily would like to do, but which complement his work. Frank agreed to sit for Lucien, and this extraordinary painting of someone thinking. It's the most sort of thinking portrait practically I know, except for one or two Rembrandts. I'm not trying to equate them, don't worry about that. But I do think that these paintings have an extraordinary quality which transcends the period they were done in, as all good art always does. A couple of years ago, I had this idea of uniting Frank and Lucien together in the V&A, and as it happened, in a room full of constables. It was just a sort of stunt. We'd done it once or twice before. We'd done it at the Wallace Collection at the Dulwich Picture Gallery, because it was a way of making Freud's new paintings be seen in London before they were shipped over to his dealer here in New York, Aquavella. And huge, huge crowds always come to these displays, which only last for a few weeks. The Wallace Collection had more people in 2 weeks than it has in a year, simply to see the new Freuds. The V&A, ditto, great blip in its attendance figures. But what I wanted to see was how Freud and Auerbach would sit together on a wall and how, without being directly connected, they would connect with Constable, because we'd recently, a couple of years before that, done this Constable selection in Paris. To pay for a kind of vanity volume we produced of a conversation we did, Freud did an etching of Constable's tree, which is a painting of a tree in North London, a little tiny painting belonging to the V&A, and one of Freud's etchings is a direct transcription of this picture. And this is in the place where we get the plates developed, plates etched. First four pulls, and one of them was okay, the second from the left, as it happens. Quality of photographs is mine, so that's why it's a bit murky. The reason the Freud tree etching was done, and the reason the Constable was so particularly interesting to Freud, was that this was a painting which he'd known at the age of 15, and which he'd tried to paint when he was in Dedham, living near Willie Lott's cottage from the Haywain. 15 years ago, he rang me up one day and he said, "I'm going a Constable." So I thought, great. And he said, "I'm doing it with Nicky." Nicky's the girl. And what he meant by that was he was going right close up to her, within sort of brush length of her, and he was going to do her just as Constable had done his tree. So to him, and this is completely genuine, there is no difference in kind between tree and person, just as human and animal. They're all, in the end, paint. And in the end, too, people are all the same. This is a painting he loves, Hogarth's Servants. Unique painting, certainly in British art, of a man painting with affection, detachment, and clarity the household he's assembled round him, his housekeepers. He's a well-to-do British painter, one of the first well-to-do British painters, and he's proud of his household, and he likes to, the only reason he can have done it is to keep their memory clean, and probably to flatter them slightly, the pleasure of sitting for him, or the patient effort of sitting for him. Freud's single heads, in some ways, I think, are his great achievement, and I certainly think in etching terms, they are his greatest achievement. This is Freud's elder brother, Clement, who kept a doorknobs and doorknockers shop and spent most of his time in the basement studying racing form. Not a man of significant talent, and yet the painting is not unsympathetic. Can I have the next one, please? On the right, the young Irishman grown up. On the left, another of Lucien's sons. This one, a son who has had a rather sad and checkered life, as you can tell from just looking at it. And again, in the etching, which you'll see upstairs, you can see there's a kind of awful self-destructive streak. Freud doesn't diminish possibilities of reading things into these, but at the same time, here, as with the portrait of a granddaughter, he gets stroppy female adolescents, I speak from experience, perfectly. And he gets the feeling that this is a child of 15 engaging with her grandfather, who she didn't really know until he came to paint her, for the first time. It's probably the first adult that she's actually leveled with, because sitting for someone like Freud, 6 hours at a time, day after day, week after week, is a considerable commitment. For poor old Hockney, who agreed to do a portrait sitting for Freud, had these six-hour sittings, on and on and on. And he said, Lucian, will you please sit for me? So Lucian said eventually he would, and sat for him for 1.5 hours, most of which time he fidgeted, and he was no use at all. The dim figure in the background is Kate Moss, and it's dim not just because it's my photograph, but because it's not a very good painting, I don't think. Glamour doesn't become him. Another single head, the most famous head in all history of all time, the most reproduced, because when you think this woman's been on the throne of Britain for something like 60 years, that she's been on postage stamps, she's been on coins, she must be more circulated than Chairman Mao ever was. She's as well known to people, certainly in the British Isles and the British Commonwealth, more well known than anybody else, and yet Freud has approached her as though she's an elderly woman, slightly bored, wearing an extraordinary hairdo, an even more extraordinary tiara crown, and is thinking about the horses she's discussing with him, and is not a flattering portrait, and in a sea of bad portraits of royalty, it's the only one, I think, that has real honesty, and by God, the newspapers went to town on it. Every front page and every paper in British Isles went with this picture and said it was awful. Well, Freud doesn't really mind about that. What he does care about is the quality of the work. When he does a print, he takes it usually on a Sunday morning to the workshop where there's a very good plate developer, and the plate develops, and we hang around for, 40 minutes, 50 minutes, an hour and a half, and halfway through this one, the resist started to lift, terrible bubbles started to appear, and there was a panic. And there he is in some gloom, watched by Eli the dog, and seeing whether this first pull is going to be irreparable or not. A lot of the etchings fail. The thing emerges, and it doesn't work, and it has to be scrapped. This one did, thanks to the genius of the printer, really. It became a very beautiful print. Lucian's reliant on his assistant, who doesn't lift a paintbrush ever or anything like that, but does everything else, including in the old days when there was a dog around, walk the dog. I put this in because Freud's paintings are very often slightly surreal, and the surreality comes about for purely practical reasons. If you haven't got a pestle and mortar for the foreground, why not put in somebody's knees? This could be taken to be some sort of tricksy thing, but actually it's practical, and any painter knows that this is a practical thing. You have to fill a canvas. A dog does as well as anything else. But ultimately, of course, it's the self-portrait that counts. Now, Freud is a retiring figure. He hates being photographed. I wasn't actually aware when I was taking these photographs, I think, that he was in the picture, his photographic image. But isn't it significant that his painted image is much more lively than he himself, reduced to the background there? And isn't it significant, too, that the motifs we've seen this evening so far have been repetitive? The animal in the studio, the plant in the studio, plant life, animal life, human life, the way in which a kind of eternal triangle is formed of living things. And in which each painting echoes its predecessor. A painting of a child, a painting of a plant. We'll hear more about this in the film in a few minutes' time. In which the outdoors, he's painted these trees, these buddleias and these undergrowth, carefully cultivated bits of undergrowth and ivy many times, and he's done etchings of them too. The view out is the alternative from the view of the sitter. And there's a plate you can see in the foreground in my badly exposed photograph, which is the third arm of subject matter and media. Recent painting, The Night Room, which is why it's low light. Rear, painting which has taken him almost 18 months to do because he's painting rather more slowly now. David's dog Eli, which has been a great subject for Freud in the last few years, and Freud himself, and the wall covered with the paint, because almost 99% of the paint that he mixes up and starts to apply to the canvas comes off the canvas and goes onto the wall, scraped off. That's where the effort and time goes. This is the painting that's currently in progress. It's a portrait of David Dawson, and at the bottom, just below the black mark, is going to be Eli when time comes and the painting is going to be enlarged. In fact, it's already being enlarged. Freud is looking at it, and he's looking also at a painting of a New Yorker on the mantelpiece. New Yorker comes over regularly. He can afford to, but he comes over every few weeks to sit for Freud, and this is the second painting of him. An etching has just been scrapped. He's 85, and the work is going on. It's an extraordinary life, and it's a long life, and it's an active life. And it's a life in which he's cultivated, not being publicized, and at the same time, he's been a dramatic life and a life full of incident. But the greatest incidents of all are in the paintings themselves. Now, the film we're going to see now is very much a film put together on a shoestring. Jake and I went around with a light camera, no equipment apart from that, and talked to the people who'd been close to Lucien for many years, going back more than 50 years, and pieced it together and produced a portrait of Freud without interviewing Freud himself. He naturally refused to be interviewed. However, I'd like you to, when you come to the point in the film where this amazing toe cap appears, keep your eyes peeled. Because, after all said and done, every painting Freud's ever done, every subject he's ever treated, is actually, as he himself has said, a self-portrait. So now we're going to look at a film which shows Freud through the eyes of those who sat for him. Can we have the film now, please?